That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news, especially since I'm finally back from Europe. I'm really excited to talk about everything that's been going on in the world and the United States. We've got some fun episodes coming up where we're going to talk about all those things, and I hope you all can listen. But before we dive into the news, just a couple of quick things, actually three quick things. First of all, please vote for us for the Signal Awards. How amazing would it be if we actually beat like Pod Save and Jon Stewart and the Daily Wire show? I think that wouldn't just be a victory for us, Derek. It would be a victory for the left. It would really be a victory for humanity. So please check out the link in the show notes.
And I mean, I'm rooting for Pod Save America because
I know you are. You're a big Pod
we
Save.
They're the resistance. They're hashtag the resistance.
Yeah, hashtag that did a lot of good, everyone. So please vote for us. Check out the link in the show notes. Another thing that happened while I was away is that we have a new website. And I would really implore people to check it out at AmericanPrestigePod.com, because one of the things that I think makes our show kind of cool, a little bit unique, is that a lot of the episodes don't really age. You could always listen to the history of the Kurds or the history of currency, the history of Vietnam, a lot of good stuff there. And one of the things, and really the major reason that we did decide to build a new website, was that we made it easy for everyone to search episodes. So if you are a subscriber to American Prestige, you could log in on the website, go to the episodes page, and just search everything. Of course, if you're not a subscriber, you're limited in the number of episodes you can search, though you could look at recent episodes as well. So again, please check out our website at AmericanPrestigePod.com. And just finally and quickly, I'm going to plug our Discord. I really think the Discord has really taken off. As I think I've said before, the conversations are really high level, really interesting. Sometimes they get a little bit personal. Derek and I are regularly on there responding. So if you're a fan of the show, if you like American Prestige, I would really check out the Discord. And again, if anything is not working on the website, please let us know. All right, Derek, let's dive headfirst into the concrete of the news. And let's start with Gaza. And let's begin with the Trump ceasefire proposal.
Right. So Donald Trump, last week during the United Nations General Assembly session, was circulating this 20 or 21, I see different accounts of this, but peace proposal, basically, you can put that all in quotes, I guess, among a number of Arab and Muslim leaders on the sidelines of the UN. They finalized this into a list that he released on Monday as he was hosting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House after some input from Netanyahu. I guess over the weekend he had met with Viceroy Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, the Trump administration envoy, and had grudgingly agreed to this thing after some changes were made by the Trump administration. And so they rolled this thing out on Monday, and Trump has now given Hamas, he said 3 or 4 days, and this was on Tuesday, although it's not clear if the clock started on Tuesday, to respond. So we're thinking, you know, I'm thinking a response has to be coming sometime today or tomorrow, most likely, may have come by the time people listen to this, but it has not come as yet. Netanyahu has agreed to the proposal, and Hamas is apparently under quite a bit of pressure to also agree. What would basically happen here is the genocide in Gaza would end immediately, according to Trump's list of ideas here. All of the remaining captives in Gaza, living and dead, would be returned to Israel. The Israelis will release a number of Palestinians who they are holding captive. And then there would be a number of steps down the road toward a potential Israeli withdrawal, although it's unclear when or whether really that would happen. under the vague language that the framework engages in. The Hamas would be obliged to disarm, which is one of Israel's goals here, or stated goals at least. The government of Gaza would be, the governance of Gaza, I guess, would be turned over to a what it calls a technocratic, apolitical Palestinian committee for day-to-day kind of management. But the real decision-making power would rest in an international board, a peace board, or board of peace, sorry, I'm getting the name wrong, that would be chaired by Trump, but would also include friend of the show, former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair, who is just can't quit the Middle East.
He's looking great these days. Everyone should take out a picture places. Of Tony
yeah,
Blair.
Yeah, he's really looking good. You know, human suffering agrees with him. So that would be the structure. There's been a pretty negative response to a lot of this from Palestinian commentators, Palestinian activists, because it doesn't have a concrete outline or concrete path to Palestinian statehood. It doesn't even have a concrete path to a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. And Netanyahu has been telling people that Israel's never going to withdraw from Gaza at this point, and that he was able to, he was apparently able to negotiate a softened language on that front into what Trump finally released on Monday, which, by the way, has gotten some reports, at least. Barak Ravid at Axios was one of these, that the Arab leaders who were briefed on this last week and had, you know, kind of fallen in line, Arab and Muslim leaders, and were pressuring Hamas, were quite angry at what was released on Monday because it wasn't what they had seen last week. They're still pushing Hamas to accept and end the genocide and get humanitarian aid into the territory. But they seem to be, at least according to these reports, they are miffed at what Netanyahu did to the document, or what Trump and Netanyahu together did to the document that they had previously seen. So, you know, at this point, we are waiting to hear from Hamas. Again, the reporting on this has been all over the map. There have been, you know, insider reports that Hamas is leaning toward accepting, or maybe accepting with some caveats based around all these considerations in terms of, are the Israelis going to leave? You know, can the Israelis restart the genocide if they feel like it? You know, what happens to this very colonial-esque system that's going to be put in place with this international board of, you know, really, let's be frank, European and American outsiders who are making decisions for Gaza? What's that going to look like? The one thing I think the Trump framework has going for it is it does explicitly seem to reject the idea of ethnically cleansing Gaza. So anybody who leaves the territory, according to this framework, anybody who leaves the territory during a reconstruction period would have the right to go back. Now, whether that would be as something that's actually upheld in practice is anybody's guess, and you could probably formulate some theories there. Nevertheless, everybody's sort of waiting to see how Hamas will respond. There's also been reporting that they're leaning toward rejecting it. So, you know, I really don't know. It's been kind of all over the map here. And I suspect anything other than just outright acceptance, if they do a conditional thing, if they say, you know, we agree to this, but there's a lot that needs to be negotiated, which is true. This is a very vague general framework of principles. It's not an implementable plan yet. Even if you know, strip the objectionable aspects from it, there's a lot of work that have to be done, to kind of flesh it out. Even if they respond with something like that, which appears to be the Qatari position and the position of some other regional countries, that you know, this is fine, we should accept it, but it's still, there's still going to be negotiation required afterward. I suspect that Netanyahu will say, "Oh, see, they rejected it. We can go back to doing what we're doing." And in that case, Trump has said, if Hamas rejects the deal, or if they accept it and then don't uphold it, he will give Netanyahu full backing for whatever horrors the Israeli government has planned for Gaza, you know, starting with Gaza City and moving on.
Speaking of Gaza City, let's talk about the IDF has issued its final evacuation notice for that city.
Yes, this was, they issued this on Wednesday. They've restated it on Thursday. Israel Katz, the Israeli defense minister, euphemistically called this the last opportunity for civilians to leave Gaza City. It is the final warning before the Israelis close off Gaza City. They've already shut the road that was open for people in southern Gaza to go back to the north. And there's one there's one road, coastal road, open for people who are still in Gaza City to get out and go south. It's only a matter of time before they close that off as well. And then they will deem anybody remaining in Gaza City to be an enemy combatant, regardless of their actual status. This has been, you know, what's been in the cards all along. And that means intensified even beyond the levels that we've seen already over the past few weeks. Intensified bombardments, really little to no concern for human life. No humanitarian aid, I would assume. How's it going to get through the Israeli encirclement? Things are going to get much worse in Gaza City very soon, unless something comes of this Trump framework and there is a halt to the conflict.
Also, this international relief flotilla seems to have been intercepted. This is an ongoing story at the time of recording, but Derek, what do we know so far?
The Global Sumud Flotilla, which has been sailing from across the Mediterranean toward Gaza for several days now, it was attacked by drones in Tunisia. It's been, you know, kind of toyed with by presumably the Israelis all along. Finally, late Wednesday began, like their live streams began going out just as it looked like they were being boarded. And the Israelis have now, it seems, intercepted the flotilla. They had started with some of its larger ships Wednesday night, and there were still smaller vessels in the flotilla that were continuing on to Gaza. But I think all of them at this point have been intercepted and turned around. The people participating in the convoy, which was trying to bring humanitarian supplies, not a huge amount. It was more of a symbolic gesture to try and break the Israeli blockade. But nevertheless, they did have some supplies that they were carrying to Gaza. Those have been impounded. The people who were involved in the flotilla have been taken into custody. The Israelis, the last I saw, said they will be deported. This is similar to the last time the Israelis intercepted the flotilla a few months ago. And so it doesn't look like they're going to try anybody. They had threatened, criminal actions against people, if they attempted to break the blockade again. So it doesn't look like they're going down that road. There's been a huge, I would say, international outcry over the interception of the flotilla. It particularly, interestingly, in Italy, there was a general strike in support of the flotilla last month, and there are calls for a new general strike. And this is like port workers and people who are involved in a lot of infrastructure activities, just threatening to shut things down in support of the flotilla. That we'll see if that comes to fruition. The Spanish government, which has been increasingly pointed in its criticisms of Israel over the last few months, has been also been kind of vocally supporting the flotilla and denouncing the Israelis for what they've been doing. The Turkish government also has offered some, at least rhetorical, support to the flotilla. We can talk about the Turkish government's position here, its rhetoric versus its actions, but that's neither here nor there. They've been critical. Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, issued a statement and also expelled whatever Israeli diplomats were left in Colombia. It's not many, because the relations between those two countries have been deteriorating. So it's been a broad negative response to the interception of the flotilla. But that's where things stand.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on and talk about Qatar. Not only did Netanyahu have to apologize to them in front of Trump, that's a great picture of Trump staring at him when he's on the phone.
He's like reading from apology over the phone. It is humiliating for Netanyahu. I guess he was
blanking. But he's done it before, right? He did it to Turkey. It's like, it's just, he just goes through it. He doesn't really care. But anyway, let's talk about this new American defense pledge that Qatar received.
Yeah, it turns out, we didn't know this at the time, but Trump signed an executive order on Monday. The White House didn't release it publicly until Wednesday, extending basically, in language, a very NATO-esque, I would say, security guarantee to Qatar. The executive order says that the United States shall regard any armed attack on the territory, sovereignty, or critical infrastructure of the state of Qatar as a threat to the peace and security of the United States. So that's pretty comprehensive. It doesn't oblige the U.S. to engage in military action in response to such an attack, but it is a strong rhetorical statement of the likes that the U.S. government has never been willing to extend to any Gulf Arab state. It doesn't have the same force as a treaty like the North Atlantic Treaty. So, you know, I don't want to get too carried away in terms of what Trump has promised here. But it seems like a potential watershed moment, or it could be at least, if the rest of the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and the UAE in particular, start coming around the White House demanding the same treatment that Qatar's getting. Now, obviously, Qatar was in a sensitive place because it already had a defense agreement with the United States, and that didn't save it from getting attacked by Israel last month. And there are still questions about what the U.S. knew about that attack and when it knew it, and how timely its warnings to the Qataris were. So Trump may have felt it necessary to do this to appease the Qataris, to keep them working in the mediation process for Gaza, and you know, and the other things that they do on behalf of the United States. Certainly forcing Netanyahu to read that apology to the, I think he was talking to the prime minister of Qatar over the phone, was another part of that process. Nevertheless, I do assume you're going to have the Saudis and the Emiratis at a minimum saying, hey, what about us? In which case the U.S. could find itself even more closely beholden to the Gulf states
and
tied to their military adventure.
More comedy festivals.
That'll be exciting. Yeah, that's,
comedy festivals can't possibly go
sideways.
All right, let's talk about Iran, where the United Nations has reimposed sanctions.
Yes, as we have talked about on the show, the so-called E3, that's France, Germany, and the UK, had invoked the 2015 nuclear deal snapback mechanism last month. The snapback mechanism makes it automatic that UN sanctions that were suspended under that accord would be reimposed. And that happened on Friday. Well, the final UN Security Council vote to delay it took place on Friday, and the council was unable to agree on delaying it. And so the sanctions officially came back into effect last weekend. This does away with any remnants of the 2015 nuclear deal. Obviously, most of that deal was gutted in 2018 when the first Trump administration pulled the U.S. out of it and really gutted it of any of the benefits that the Iranians were supposed to get. But this kind of, you know, tears up the last little bit of the deal, which was supposed to sunset anyway in October, which is the reason why the E3 invoked these sanctions, or invoked the snapback mechanism to reimpose these sanctions. Also because the E3 has been trying to cozy up, the group of them have been trying to cozy up to the U.S. and they saw this as a way to do it because they have other things that they want from Donald Trump, chiefly vis-a-vis Ukraine. But they saw this as an easy way to sacrifice the Iranians on the altar of doing something that they hoped would get them in good graces with Donald Trump. The economic impact of these reimposed UN sanctions remains to be seen. Iran is obviously already under very heavy U.S. sanctions that have crippled its economy. So there's not much room to get worse. There is some, though, and we saw in the immediate aftermath of the sanctions coming back online, the rial crashed to its lowest level ever, well over 1 million to the dollar. So there is room for things to get worse to some degree. And there seems to be a lot of consternation in Iran about how bad things might get at this point. I will say the Russian government, at a minimum, I don't know if the Chinese government has had a public statement about this, but I've seen a public statement from the Russian government that basically says they regard this whole thing, the reinvocation of snapback and the implementation of these sanctions, as illegitimate. They're not going to abide by it. They've already not been abiding by the U.S. sanctions. So it sounds like Russia, at least, will continue to trade with Iran. I imagine China will continue to do so as well. So that cushions the blow to some degree you know, it's not a full reprieve, but it should be a lifeline to the Iranian economy to some measure.
The multipolar world blossoms before our very eyes. Let's talk about
We really don't know. I should add, we really don't know what the Iranians are going to do. They've threatened to pull out of the non-proliferation treaty at times. Some officials have threatened to pull out of the NPT. Other officials have said, no, we would never do that. They've been sending conflicting messages on that. And there are other steps they could take. I think they kicked out. Or they pulled their ambassadors from the E3 nations over the weekend as the sanctions were coming back online. But there's still a response here that's going to be coming, and that could frame potential, even a potential return to conflict if the Israelis and the U.S. decide they need to bomb Iran again in response to this. We'll see.
Wow, Derek, I'm away for a few weeks and you interrupt me. Interesting.
Yes.
Let's move on to Afghanistan. And let's talk about Trump, who wants to reopen Bagram Air Base.
Yeah, he's very adamant about this. Bagram apparently is U.S. property. I think it was built by the Soviets, so technically doesn't belong to the U.S.
Well, they believe in communal property, so it's everyone's property.
Well, okay, we could share. No, but he's been talking about this publicly. Apparently he's been deliberating about it in private for months, kind of complaining to his advisors that the Biden administration gave up Bagram when it withdrew from Afghanistan. I don't know how the U.S. would have held on to Bagram as the Taliban was taking over again in 2021, but this seems to be, somehow Trump feels like the withdrawal could have included the U.S. Retaining Bagram Air Base. And so he's been kind of agitated about this. He threatened some unspecified punishment for the Afghan government if it didn't turn over Bagram Air Base. This was a couple of weeks ago. If it didn't turn over Bagram Air Base to the U.S. There have been apparently negotiations. The Wall Street Journal reported this a few days ago that there have been some kind of low-level talks between U.S. and Afghan officials about stationing a small U.S. counterterrorism presence of some kind at Bagram, and whether this would include and what this would mean, how many personnel. It would probably be mostly a drone operation, but that would still require U.S. Personnel to be present at the facility. So the talks haven't really gone anywhere. They're very preliminary, but they've been sort of in the context of other conversations that the Trump administration has been having with the Taliban, primarily around prisoner releases. But there've been some, some talk of economic aid or security deals, that sort of thing. This could, happen in the context of that. The ultimate card would be, of course, for the U.S. to recognize the Taliban-led government of Afghanistan. That would be huge for them. That doesn't seem to be on the table yet. The thing is, with the journal report, it's interesting, but what Trump has said that he wants to do is take Bagram back and control it and use it as a facility to spy on China, because it's located close enough to the facility where China allegedly maintains tests and sort of works on its nuclear weapons program, that it could be useful in that regard. Now, I at least to my mind, there's virtually no way that the Taliban would allow the United States to spy on China from Afghanistan. But this is Trump's. This is what Trump has said publicly. So that's much bigger, a much bigger deal than a little counterterrorism operation. So I don't know where the disconnect is here, but it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't seem like everybody's on the same page with this.
Let's also talk about this internet outage that happened in Afghanistan.
On Monday, Afghan internet service collapsed. The connectivity collapsed in what looks to have been a deliberate decision to cut off the country's fiber optic cables. The Taliban has been sort of cutting province by province, or in a few select provinces over the last few months, has been cutting internet service amid what it calls a morality play, or some sort of thing. It's a crackdown on immorality, I guess, is what they've called it. That they have been threatening to do a nationwide blackout instead of going province by province. And so on Monday when this happened, there's a group called NetBlocks that monitors kind of internet connectivity, said that Afghanistan's connectivity levels had dropped to something like 14% of its usual load. So it looked like there had been a deliberate decision taken to cut the internet. It came back online, interestingly enough, on Wednesday. Everything, I mean, at least what had been in place on before the cut on Monday came back, seems to have come back online, or most of it anyway. Especially in Kabul, there was reporting that people were finally able to reaccess the internet. So it's unclear what happened. If there was a deliberate decision on Monday to cut the internet on morality grounds, surely they had not solved the immorality of the internet by Wednesday. So it's unclear why the Taliban would have turned things back on. There are a lot of concerns here, and there were a lot of concerns during this two-day blackout about what it might mean for Afghan women, many of whom have taken to the internet to try and access educational resources, even to try and access kind of online employment resources, since they've been barred from virtually any aspect of life outside the home by the Taliban. There was a great deal of concern that cutting the internet off would, and this is surely the point, would have, you know, further restricted what little opportunities remain for Afghan women. So the fact that everything came back online Wednesday, I think, changes things a bit. It's still unclear to me what actually happened, whether somebody got overeager and just decided to cut the whole country off and they weren't ready for that, or there was some error as they were cutting, you know, like, again, cutting service to specific provinces and they wound up cutting the whole country off. I just don't know. But for now, things seem to be in a very confusing place. Adding to the confusion, there was a statement that circulated on Wednesday, purportedly from the Afghan Taliban, that they had released on, I believe, Telegram, denying kind of angrily that there had been an intentional blackout or they had intentionally cut the fiber optic cables. That statement turned out to be a fake. So that just added to everybody's sort of confusion about what's going on here.
Let's move on to Sudan, where tragically starvation is rising in El Fasher.
The Sudan Doctors Network, which is one of several NGOs, local NGOs that operate in Sudan, said on the last week, said late last week, that it had tallied at least 23 malnutrition-related deaths in the city of El Fasher over the course of September. That's not a huge number in the big scheme of things. The full death toll in Al Fasher is the Rapid Support Forces militant group continues to besiege that city, which is in North Darfur state. The overall death toll was something on the order of 90 to 100. So it's a percentage, but it, like what we've seen in Gaza, this is how you sort of cross over from a risk of starvation to an actual epidemic of starvation. You know, it's with a few cases here and there, but it means that months of deprivation, months of going without humanitarian aid for the people who have been besieged in that city is starting to come due. Like the consequences are starting to reveal themselves. So it is certainly a dire time in that city. The RSF has been pushing to take Al-Fashir and the surrounding displaced persons camp, Abu Shouk, for weeks now, very intensely attacking, you know, making incursions, even I think setting up some positions in the refugee camp, the displaced persons camp. But they still haven't been able to take the city. And the Sudanese military claimed earlier this week to have conducted an airdrop of supplies to its remaining units in Al-Fashir to try and bolster their position, which just means the blockade and the starvation are going to continue. Not that a resolution here is necessarily going to fix anything. The RSF is at this point quite notorious in the its origins in the Janjaweed militia, which carried out most of the Darfur genocide, make it even more notorious for its mistreatment of non-Arab populations in Darfur. And there's every reason to expect that if they take the city, there will be mass casualties and maybe not very much consideration given getting aid into getting aid to people who need it or kind of flooding the city to try and alleviate the starvation, flooding it with food and other supplies. So I think this is probably only going to get worse at this point, unless by some miracle the siege is broken somehow or there's an influx of humanitarian aid, which doesn't seem very likely.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. We've all done it before, turning to our barista, hairdresser, or even a random stranger for life advice. As fun as they are to talk with about everyday topics, when you're looking for help about relationships, anxiety, depression, or other clinical issues, they may not have all the right answers. Instead, get guidance from a credentialed therapist online with BetterHelp. With over 30,000 clinically trained therapists, BetterHelp has a 4.9 rating out of 1.7 million client session reviews. You can join a session at the click of a button. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. Find the one with BetterHelp. Listeners get 10% off with their first month at BetterHelp.com/TheNation. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TheNation.
Let's talk about these quote-unquote Gen Z protests in Madagascar and Morocco.
This is becoming a trend, I guess. I mean, we've seen protests this year in Kenya that are being categorized as you said, Gen Z protests. The protest in Nepal last month that ousted the government of that country were characterized as Gen Z protests. And we're now seeing them in Madagascar, as you said, and Morocco. Basically, you know, the commonalities here are young people organizing online over a series of grievances. In Madagascar's case, the protests seem to be mostly concentrated in Antananarivo, the capital of Madagascar. People are upset over basically the degradation of public utilities. There are water shortages, power shortages consistently that people are dealing with. In Morocco, similarly, there's anger over underfunded public services. Corruption also, of course, is a common thread here. People frustrated over corruption, or at least the perception of corruption. In Morocco, there's a lot of frustration over kind of schools, libraries, hospitals, services like that being underfunded by the government at the same time that people can see massive construction projects underway, paid for by the government in preparation for the 2030 World Cup, which Morocco is going to host. So the contrast there seems to have driven people into the street. In both of these cases, these more recent cases, Madagascar and Morocco, there's been the protests have gotten violent. At least 22 people have been killed in Madagascar over about a week of protesting at this point. The president of Madagascar, Andry Rajoelina, dissolved his government on Monday in an attempt to appease the protesters. That has not worked. They're continuing to demonstrate. They're calling for his resignation. In Morocco, at least two people were killed, and I don't know the circumstance. I believe they were shot by police in a city in southern Morocco, or a town in southern Morocco on Wednesday night, so sort of overnight, Wednesday into Thursday. That was the fifth straight night of protests, and surely there will be more to come. Those were, to my knowledge, the first fatalities connected with these protests, but dozens of people have been injured, according to the Moroccan government. Scores of members of the security forces have been injured. There've been, a couple dozen protesters injured, many arrests. That one, you know, we'll see how that unfolds. There may be a bit less flexibility given that Morocco is a rather authoritarian monarchy, as opposed to a presidential Republican type government in Madagascar, but we'll see, how heavy the crackdown gets as things move forward.
Let's move on to Ukraine, and let's start with Trump, who has adopted another new position on the war.
Last week, so amazing. Last week, he popped onto social media to declare out of the blue that he believes that Ukraine can retake all of the territory that has lost to Russia, presumably including Crimea, which it lost to Russia in 2014. And I don't mean to make light of the plight of Ukraine, obviously, but This is a delusional thing to state, really. The course of this war has given no indication that it would be possible for the Ukrainians to do this on a military basis. Trump said he is getting to know and fully understand the war. And that's why he's suddenly, after months of saying, you know, the war has to end, Ukraine's being pounded, it's got to end now. You know, initially, before he took office, saying he was going to end the war in 24 hours upon going and getting into the White House. We've now come all the way around from that to Ukraine can fight until it retakes all of its territory, which just doesn't seem realistic. Nor does it seem realistic that Donald Trump fully understands the war or really anything else, given the state of his brain. What he really seemed to be doing, and I think a lot of people have pointed this out, what he really seemed to be doing with this statement was sort of washing his hands of the war. He's tried to broker meetings between Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky. He's tried to sort of advance a peace process of sorts. And has been stymied by mostly Putin. You know, Zelensky has dragged his feet on some points that seem to be, you know, more pro-Russia. But Putin has been, you know, I would say, more intransigent, or at least seems to be frustrating Trump more. Perhaps that's because he felt like he and Putin were simpatico, and yet Putin has not really helped him out to get this done. So this seems like he's maybe washing his hands of the war. He's also managed, and this, you know, kind of achieves, I think, his real aim, which is not necessarily ending the war, just getting the U.S. out of kind of actively participating in it on the Ukrainian side. He's also reached a point where he's gotten the Ukrainians and NATO's European members to agree that basically the U.S. role here should not be kind of providing aid to Ukraine. It should be selling weapons to Ukraine, which is a more passive thing that brings revenue into the United States. So Trump is much more amenable to that than the idea that the U.S. should be kind of, you know, providing support of its own free will or volition. He's happier to sell weapons. And the arrangement that's now in place is the European NATO members extend credit to Ukraine that, you know, may or may not ever be paid off, but they're using that to buy U.S. weapons and send to the Ukrainians. And again, Trump is pretty happy to sell weapons. That's been well established over, you know, a full term plus at this point of his presidency. He's always happy to sell weapons to people. So he seems pretty comfortable with where things are, and maybe is just stepping away from the war. He was, you know, as I said, getting frustrated with his alleged role as peacemaker. So he's just not going to do that anymore.
Just happy for our defense contractors. They've really been suffering since 2022. It, yeah. So they deserve it. Let's talk about the EU, which appears to be warming up to seizing Russian assets in European countries.
This was reported in Al Jazeera. It's been reported in a couple other places. There's an EU summit going on right now in Denmark, where they do appear, as you say, to be warming up to the idea of using seized Russian assets. This is one of Trump's demands, actually, of Europe, that they use these Russian assets to support aid for Ukraine or support arms purchases. I think in his mind, and again, this is reflective of how frustrated he's gotten with Putin, he's been imagining that they would just seize the money and you know, buy weapons with it. The Europeans have been reluctant to do that because it calls into question the sanctity of European banks, which take a lot of deposits from a lot of unsavory people around the world, and they would like to continue doing that because it's financially beneficial to European countries. So they don't want to do anything that's really going to freak out potential depositors. But what they have been talking about, and what seems to be approaching a point where they're going to be ready to act on it, is extending a loan to Ukraine. The latest number I've seen is 140 billion euros, which is about $165 billion, that would be guaranteed, basically, or you know, the collateral would be provided by the Russian assets that the European Union has frozen in member states' banks. It has not seized, but is frozen, so the Russians can't access them. It would use that as collateral in advance of a future, at some point, payment by Ukraine. The plan would also absolve Ukraine of having to make any payment until it receives some sort of reparations from Russia for having, you know, invaded in 2022. That would, again, be guaranteed, I guess, or the collateral would be held with these seized Russian assets, which could, at that point, if the Russians, you know, if the war ends and the Russians say, you know, screw you, we're not paying any reparations, they could, at that point, I guess, take the assets and say, you know, guess what, you've already made your reparations payments, but who knows? They're sort of trying to bridge the divide between members who are concerned about what this might mean for the banks and members who are more eager to kind of take advantage of these funds to do something for Ukraine to support it financially and militarily.
All right, Derek, let's move on to Latin America and let's talk about Milei. The libertarian utopia has not worked out as Elon Musk and others have predicted.
It's going so well that he needs a bailout from the United States, about $20 billion. He's already relying on pretty heavily on IMF loans to keep things going. And that's, I guess, no longer viable. So now he's talking to the Trump administration about a bailout. Milei's libertarian experiment seems to be fizzling out. Inflation is going up again after initially dropping as he was, cutting social spending and, you know, trying to balance the budget, etc. It seems to be creeping back up. The Argentina's export business is down. The austerity is starting to bite politically. There was a local election in Buenos Aires province, I believe, back in early last month, that Milei's party suffered a pretty substantial defeat that shook, I think, investor confidence in his project and whether or not it's going to continue. The investors, of course, love austerity, but if Milei is losing ground politically, then that suggests that the austerity is not going to continue. And so, yes, the Trump administration has been talking about bailing him out. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, last week announced that the U.S. is ready to offer somewhere around $20 billion in currency swaps that would bring dollars into Argentina to bolster its flagging, depleting foreign currency reserves. This is all on the table. I will say there's some frustration here that has emerged even within the sort of MAGA universe about the idea of bailing out Milei, because Milei has been selling soybeans to China, and China stopped buying U.S. soybeans when, you know, Donald Trump started imposing tariffs, massive tariffs on China. Beijing responded by ending its purchases of U.S. Agricultural products, which has been devastating for soybean and corn farmers who are part, you know, in many cases of the MAGA extended universe. So there's been some frustration that the United States is going to bail out a guy who has gone around the U.S. backs and is helping China by selling them basically discounted soybeans to help them make up for the soybeans that they're no longer buying from the U.S. So that may be a topic for conversation. I think Trump and Milei are supposed to meet in a couple of weeks to discuss a range of things. One of those things may be, why Milei is selling soybeans to China in defiance of the U.S. And whether or not that impacts on the proposed bailout, we'll see.
And let's talk about Venezuela, where the United States might be planning to strike within the country.
This is a report in NBC News late last week that the U.S. military is drawing up, I'll just quote from them, drawing up options to target drug traffickers inside Venezuela, and strikes within that country's borders could potentially begin in a matter of weeks. There's no approval for any strikes like that yet, but it is the next step after the U.S. has started, you know, randomly blowing up speedboats in the Southern Caribbean on the basis that they're supposedly carrying Venezuelan drugs and gang members. It was probably only a matter of time before we got to something like this. It is part and parcel of an effort to weaken Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, either to hasten his removal from office or to, you know, get him to offer concessions to the U.S. What those might look like, I don't know. But yeah, things appear to be advancing within the administration on this front. And this could be the next great regime change project for the United States. So we'll eagerly look forward to that.
Yeah, and we'll keep you updated, of course, if anything happens. All right, Derek, let's end with this generals meeting that Pete Hegseth called. I know there was a lot of anxiety in anticipation of it, understandably, that he was going to force them to like take a loyalty oath to Trump, because people might know the military actually takes a loyalty oath to the Constitution, which I believe is actually a Cold War invention. It's not that old, but it turned out to be mostly kind of a pep talk. So, Derek, what happened?
The dumbest thing. I mean, really, there was all this consternation. Like, what's he going to do? What's this going to mean? And there were some troubling things, certainly, that happened at this rally. But the Hegseth part in particular was just a ridiculous pep rally where he was like trying to pump up this room of generals and admirals who are all fairly old, experienced folks who don't really react to that sort of thing. And didn't react for the most part to Hegseth's speech. It was a lot of like, you know, we're gonna, you know, kick ass and take names. I mean, I, you know, it was so silly. It almost doesn't bear going into. At one point, he invoked the fuck around, find out rule and warned America's enemies, and then waited for like, I think he was waiting for an applause line. He was like, to our enemies, F-A-F-O. And then he waited for like the generals to start whooping. And there was like dead silence. Like two of Hegseth's aides were like, woohoo. And then the generals just sat there. The generals and admirals just sat there, silent. So I don't know that it went as well as he was hoping. He did kind of ramble through a number of things, number of changes that he wants to make. He clearly wants to get women out of combat roles, for example. There was some of that. He railed against DEI, the usual kind of list of bullshit grievances that these people have. The troubling part, I think, was when Donald Trump spoke. And there was, you know, Trump had been a late addition to this rally, but he did show up and he did speak. His portion of things was troubling for two reasons. One was most of it didn't make any sense. It was just the dying gasps of a brain that stopped functioning normally sometime in the 1980s. But the stuff that was coherent enough to piece together was basically he's going to order the U.S. military to invade a whole host of American cities and take them over because of, you know, what he called a war from within, which ought to chill anybody who thinks about the implications of that. He also said that the generals, the assembled brass, the generals and admirals should regard these incursions into U.S. cities as training opportunities for the U.S. military, I guess, for operations overseas, which I appreciated as sort of an inverse of the usual imperial boomerang where you, you know, train on people abroad to do things that you then bring back and do to your own people. This seems to be the inverse of that. We're going to, you know, brutalize the American people and then go inflict that on people overseas, which is an interesting reversal, but no less worrisome, I think, in terms of the rhetoric that he was using.
Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. It is actually good to be back, even though things aren't going so great here. It was nice to get away, but I'm back and happy to get into the groove of things. Again, the one thing that we do ask of you is if you could vote for us in the Signal Awards, check out that link in the show notes. I would just love to beat PodSafe. That would just be very, very cool. And as always, thank you all for listening and keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.